Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight I want to talk a little bit about the period after 1978 in China and the economic reforms. Perhaps they're best described as changes, because reform is always a moot point, introduced by Deng Xiaoping and the aftermath of Mao's cultural revolution. One of the reasons for talking about this is because, or perhaps the primary reason for talking about this, is because we live in the kind of the historical aftermath of what occurred in China in the late 1970s and early 1980s. It is a transition of global importance, and perhaps we won't really fully understand the ramifications of it until we are further into the 21st century. But it has potential to transform the world in the way that Britain's Industrial Revolution did in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. Anyway, so today we're going to be looking once again at David Harvey's Brief History of Neoliberalism. David Harvey, a professor of anthropology, Marxist critic, and a kind of polymathic figure whose analyses of the functioning of capitalism are kind of peerless, really. And if we are questioning how does capital function in the 21st century, to overlook the role of China would be to really kind of misunderstand the entire system. So David Harvey writes, "In December 1978, faced with the dual difficulties of political uncertainty in the wake of Mao's death in 1976 and several years of economic stagnation, the Chinese leadership under Deng Xiaoping announced a program of economic reform. We may never know for sure whether Deng was all along a secret capitalist roader, as Mao had claimed during the Cultural Revolution, or whether the reforms were simply a desperate move to ensure China's economic security and bolster its prestige in the face of the rising tide of capitalist development in the rest of East and Southeast Asia." So, Let's just dwell on these two points. Mao had really despised Deng since 1962 at the very very latest. Deng and Liu Shaoqi were given control over the Chinese economy following and the Chinese state following the disaster of the Great Leap Forward and the epic famine that Mao caused, that killed anywhere between 40 and 70 million people. Mao became a kind of a political non-entity for 4 years, returning in 1966 begin his assault on the party that had spurned him, and his era of the Cultural Revolution, this kind of revolutionary populism where he tried to reach beyond the bureaucratic structures of the party to speak directly to the people or directly to the students and those who and to young people encourage this assault on the party. Deng was purged twice during the Cultural Revolution, and was son was brutally injured and left a paraplegic. Deng, I believe, wound up working in a bicycle shop towards the end of the Cultural Revolution, and so he was very much a consummate political survivor. Was he a capitalist roader? I personally don't think so. I don't think Deng really thought in these terms. I think that his later pragmatism, he says essentially it doesn't matter whether the cat is black or white, but as long as it catches mice. His view was, and it was also famously quoted as saying, poverty is not socialism. That in order to provide stability for China and to ensure the survival of the party and of the regime, a mass prosperity, mass affluence, was the only way forward. Coming along to the second point that David Harvey makes, was it something to do with the rest of Southeast Asia at the time? Well, during the 1960s and 70s, Mao looked on with great concern that South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Japan all had become beacons of capitalist modernity. All had used their position geographically and their populations in order to create a boom in light industry and finance, and by the 1970s, of course, Japan has captured America as an export market for transistor radios, cars, motorcycles, and other goods. And at the same time, China is languishing in the chaos of the Cultural Revolution. Mao was always hugely concerned about China being surrounded by enemies, and about capitalism being a kind of a gateway on China's doorstep into destroying the communist regime. Deng saw it, I believe, in a slightly different way, in that he believed that unless China was able to compete with these powers, it would become a backwater, and it would become once again a kind of de facto colony when it became weak enough, as had occurred during the 19th century. Deng Xiaoping did not want the Chinese Communist Party to become the 20th century equivalent of the Qing Dynasty. The reforms just happened to coincide, writes David Harvey, and it's very hard to consider this anything other than a conjunctural accident of world historical significance, with the turn to neoliberal solutions in Britain and the United States. The outcome in China had been the construction of a particular kind of market economy that increasingly incorporates neoliberal elements into digitated with authoritarian centralized control. Elsewhere, as in Chile, South Korea, Taiwan, and Singapore, the compatibility between authoritarianism and the capitalist market had already been clearly established. So, one of the more sort of Western centric views of neoliberalism. This is kind of one of the articles of faith of people like Friedrich von Hayek, was that the reduction in size of the state and the introduction of market mechanisms into the allocation of goods in society, and the mass destruction of trade union power, and the idea that individuals would be liberated into this world of economic choice, that this would bring about this notion of liberty. Hayek as an emigre from Nazism and a critic of Soviet communism said, what do these things have in common? They are both the product of big states, and when the state gets big enough, so the theory goes, then it will become tyrannical. And he had some slightly implausible argument that Western social democratic states, with their high taxing and spending and their large commitment to welfare states, nationalisation and trade union power, would become essentially tyrannies. And what he, I suppose, really meant was they would become tyrannical to people of property. They would tax people of wealth and redistribute that to the poor. But the idea of shrinking this state would free up the liberty of everybody. So Hayek thought. Hayek actually later went on to make some highly anti-democratic statements, but that's a story from another time. But what China and Chile and other places like Taiwan, which were far from being libertarian societies in the 1970s, and South Korea. What they showed was that free market economics could live quite neatly alongside repressive authoritarian or even dictatorial states. While egalitarianism as a long-term goal for China was not abandoned, Deng argued that individual and local initiative had to be unleashed in order to increase productivity and spark economic growth. The corollary that certain levels of inequality should inevitably arise was well understood as something that would need to be tolerated. Under the slogan of Zhao Kang, the concept of an ideal society that provides well for its citizens, Deng focused on four modernizations in agriculture, industry, education, and science and defense. The reforms strove to bring market forces to bear internally within the Chinese economy. The idea was to stimulate competition between state-owned firms and thereby spark, it was hoped, innovation and growth. So there are some kind of interesting parallels there with the Western model of neoliberalism, in that from the 1970s onwards, the idea that a commitment to full employment, for example, could be sustained indefinitely in Great Britain came under increasing attack. In 1979, when Margaret Thatcher came to power, the recession that she and her Chancellor Geoffrey Howe manufactured in the 1979.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Budget, which lasted really until 1983, even into 1984, caused a huge bubble of, well, a huge swell of unemployment, sending unemployment figures into kind of Great Depression sort of levels, nearing 3 million. And the reasoning, the cause of this was the decision to, the monetarist decision to restrict the money supply in Great Britain, which was the part of the kind of the Keynes, the Hayekian and Friedmanite economic argument, was that inflation was caused by an excessive amount of money in the system, and if you combat inflation, that will also lead to the eventually to high levels of productivity, and then eventually to lower levels overall in the long term of unemployment. And you sort of sweat inflation out of the system by shutting down the money supply. This turns out to be kind of fairly voodoo economics, and the basis of it was utterly misproven within a couple of years. But the levels of human misery that this resulted in still scar British society now. And the idea that supply side economics work is still kind of an article of faith for both British political parties. But the connection with Deng here was this retreat from this egalitarian idea that a certain amount of inequality and a certain amount of poverty would have to be tolerated in the pursuit of this greater and superior economic goal. Of course, the contexts are fundamentally different, and this was China emerging from the Cultural Revolution, and the product of Maoist equality, or attempts at equality, had been basically a race to the bottom, not lifting anybody up, but a race to the bottom in terms of impoverishing those who had previously been wealthy at all since 1949. But the sparking of modernizations and the desire to see state-run entities compete with one another, this was a slightly different direction from the neoliberalism of the West. British and American neoliberalism didn't require state-owned firms to compete with one another. Instead, privatisation, the selling of things like British Telecom and British Rail, British Rail was in the 1990s, was how the state divested itself of the need to have large parts of British industry on the balance sheet and to be accountable for it and to fund it. And it also, in Margaret Thatcher's eyes, was a way of trying to democratise British capitalism. Her view was that the sluggish British capitalism of the 1970s could be given a forceful kick in the rear end by shareholders. And if ordinary people, millions of them, became shareholders in state industries, then one would have democratised financial capitalism as well, which was when Thatcher came to power, the preserve of the gentleman investor, by and large. But having a shareholding democracy would make British companies accountable to British people. So goes the logic. Of course, this didn't happen, because what generally tended to occur was people would buy shares, the shares would shoot up in price, and then larger investors, institutional investors, would buy the shares and give ordinary shareholders a small but attractive profit. This meaning that instead of democratizing British capital, it was handed wholesale to third parties, often foreign businesses. Not what Mrs. Thatcher intended, but here the Chinese government under Deng was unwilling to do anything that looked like privatization at this point, and instead believed that creating artificial markets within the ownership of the Chinese state was what would work. This has actually been tried to sort of really dismal effect in Russia under the reforms of Alexei Kosygin and Brezhnev in the previous decade, from the late 60s to the mid 70s. Market pricing was introduced, but this was probably far less civic significant than the rapid devolution of political economic power to the regions and to the localities. This last move proved particularly astute. Confrontation with traditional power centres in Beijing was avoided, and local initiatives could pioneer the way to a new social order. Innovations that failed could simply be ignored. To supplement this effort, China was also opened up, albeit under strict state supervision, to foreign trade and foreign investment, thus ending China's isolation from the world market. So, in a bid to take power away from party apparatchiks in Beijing, who could simply just say no to things, devolving power to regions meant that they could sidestep conservative-minded bureaucrats, and also, if anything went wrong, you could kind of bury it in the regions. If there are initiatives that failed, you can kind of ignore them, and you can allow people allow the party almost to be ignorant of them. Opening up is another key part of this process, and I will talk about this in greater depth another time. But the development of special economic zones, places like Shenzhen, in my childhood days in Hong Kong, the city of Shenzhen that had grown from in the late 1970s to being being a place with about 30,000 people, was by then in the mid 1980s a place with, I imagine, from my recollections, about 1 or 2 million people, and right now it has a population of something approaching 30 million people. It is a an economic, social, and geographical transformation, probably unlike any other in world history. It is the development of special economic zones, which were areas where foreign businesses could seek cheap labour for manufacturing and could bring foreign investment and, what China really sought, foreign technology. China was very keen on technology transfers, and Deng went to see both Gerry Ford and Jimmy Carter in the 1970s to plead the case for technology transfers. And they, got them by hook or by crook through the special economic zones. But the significant point here was that the special economic zones were in the 1980s quarantined from the rest of China for fear by the party that some kind of capitalist contagion would spread. Deng obviously was fully aware that this would happen and saw it as being an entirely good thing. And the way in which the island of Hong Kong was used as a conduit into the special economic zones is interesting. David Harvey writes, experimentation was initially limited, mainly to Guangdong province, where Shenzhen is, close to Hong Kong, conveniently remote from Beijing. One aim of this opening up to the outside was to procure technology transfers hence the emphasis on joint ventures between foreign capital and Chinese partners. The other was to gain enough foreign reserves to buy in the necessary means to support a stronger internal dynamic of economic growth. In a way, the building up of reserves to try to build up infrastructure was what Stalin and Mao had both tried to achieve through forced industrialization, and this was now another way of trying to solve that problem, trying to bring about economic transformation as quickly as possible. Deng, again, an ultimate pragmatist who had committed many atrocities in Mao's name on behalf of the party, and particularly during the Chinese Civil War, and so was loyal to the party itself, and simply saw economics as a kind of a rather an agnostic kind of device, something that had no defined meaning one way or another, as long as the party was served. And this is how we get this fusion of authoritarianism and neoliberalism emerging in the late 1970s and the early 1980s. There's much more to say on this, and obviously we will revisit this soon. But anyway, I hope you found it useful. Do check us out on the Explaining History Facebook group. Pop by and find us on Patreon. There's always something interesting happening there. And I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.